will lead us in that devotional. So just a few things for you to keep in mind with that weekend coming up. When we look at the seven churches of Asia in Revelation chapters 2 and 3, all of God's promises for eternal good in those chapters, for these seven churches to whom that epistle, that letter was addressed, all of the promises from God for eternal good are for overcomers. In every letter to every church, eternal blessings are promised to those who overcome. It is the one who overcomes who will eat from the tree of life, who will not be hurt by the second death, who will be given a new name and power over the nations. Only overcomers will be clothed in white garments and have their name written in the book of life. Only overcomers are made pillars in the temple of God and granted by God to sit with Him on His throne. Only overcomers. But what were they, and by extension, what are we supposed to be overcoming to receive all of these great and matchless spiritual blessings in Christ? Well, for four of the seven churches that Jesus addresses here in Revelation chapter 2 and 3, it was compromise with the world that they had to overcome. For Pergamos, it was compromise with false teaching that came from the world. For Thyatira, it was compromise with the pressures to blend in with the world. For the church in Sardis, it was compromise with the immorality of the world. And for Laodicea, it was compromise with the riches of the world. In a word, these churches needed to overcome worldliness if they were to be approved by God and if the people who made up these churches were to be saved. So little has changed. Much of the battle for us as Christians today, people who are called to be in the world but not of the world, is in that concept of overcoming worldliness. What is worldliness? Well, it's becoming like the world. It is doing the things that the world does. We might say that it is being conformed to the world. And I say we might say that, but really that's what the Apostle Paul says. That we are worldly when we are conformed to what the world is, what it wants us to do, ahead of the things of God. So I hope you're there in Romans chapter 12. Let's begin reading in verse 1. Romans chapter 12, this is really the beginning of the super practical part of the book of Romans, where Paul says all of those deep theological things that we've talked about, let's put them into practice in our everyday life. And so he begins this practical section by saying in verse 1 of Romans chapter 12, I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. Paul says, don't be conformed, but be transformed. And to overcome worldliness, this text suggests that we need to do two things. Number one, we need to identify conformation with the world in ourselves. We need to examine ourselves to see if we are conformed to this world. And then number two, we need to embrace transformation. We need to do what God requires of us to be transformed out of that worldly person that we were into the spiritual one that He intends for us to be. And so this morning, let's unpack those two ideas, that we might identify confirmation if it's in ourselves, and that we might embrace the transformation that God has for us. So number one, let's identify confirmation. I doubt that there are any Christians who say, oh yeah, I'm conformed to the world. I'm a worldly Christian. That's me. I'll raise my hand. No spirituality here. That's not the way we think about it. That's not the way we think about ourselves. Who would say that, right? The problem is when we become this way without realizing it. In 2 Corinthians chapter 2 and verse 11, the Apostle Paul said, "We are not ignorant of Satan's devices, but maybe sometimes we are." They weren't, but maybe we are. Perhaps we are in the grasp of the devil and we don't even know it. And we cannot be ignorant in regard to worldliness. And I think a good biblical example of someone who ended up being worldly without even realizing it was Abraham's nephew Lot, as primarily described in Genesis chapter 19. Lot's whole family was worldly. And it seems like he didn't even know it until it was too late. He conformed to the world. The world got into his family without him even realizing it had happened. And we can learn a lot from Lot. Specifically, may I suggest that we see in Lot seven signs of what we might call Christian worldliness. I know Lot wasn't a Christian, but these seven things still apply to us today, where we think we're Christians, and maybe we're doing a lot of things for the Lord, and yet worldliness still defines who we are. Number one, if we make choices based primarily on worldly considerations instead of spiritual considerations, it might be that we have conformed to the world. Turn to Genesis chapter 13. We'll get to Genesis 19 here in just a second. But in Genesis chapter 13, we remember that Lot and Abraham have both reached the land of Canaan and they have both been abundantly blessed by God to the point that there is strife between the two big camps, Abraham's camp and Lot's camp, and all of their flocks and herds and servants. And so Abraham comes to Lot and says, "Hey, we're brethren, we're family, we shouldn't have conflict with one another, and so you pick one way to go and go that way, and I'll pick the other way and I'll go that way so that there's no strife between us." So notice what Lot chooses there in verse 10. "And Lot lifted his eyes and saw all the plain of Jordan that was well watered everywhere before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. Like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt as you go toward Zoar." Then Lot chose for himself all the plain of Jordan, and Lot journeyed east, and they separated from each other. Lot chooses to go to Sodom because the grass was greener. I mean, literally, the grass was greener there. It was like the garden of Eden, right? And we have to be careful that we don't make choices in our life just primarily based on what looks better physically. Who am I going to date? Well, I want it to be somebody I'm compatible with. I want it to be somebody who looks nice. Not that I'm going to be dating anybody, but thinking in those terms, right? That's what I wanted, right? That's what you ought to want too. But what's most important in who I date? And certainly in who I marry, I want to choose someone who is devoted to spiritual things. I want to choose someone who's going to help me get to heaven. And yet sometimes things like compatibility become most important. Well, the most important compatibility is spiritual compatibility. We ask ourselves, like, where am I going to go to college? And that's a big, big question. And certainly there's some financial things to think about in that, right? Who is it that's going to offer me the most money? Where am I going to get to go and get the degree that I want to get in the least amount of time? Perhaps there is some challenge there. You know, I've been working to get in this certain university and I want to go there. And all of those things are good. But shouldn't the first consideration be, is there a faithful church there? Is this a place where I'm going to grow spiritually? Am I going to be throwing myself or my children to the wolves? Or are they going to have a support system for spiritual things? What am I going to do for a living? Am I going to work or am I going to stay home with the kids? And on and on and on we could go. These are questions where the answer isn't usually righteousness and sinfulness. But a lot of times the answers are what is more physical and worldly and what is more spiritual and godly. Which of those will we choose when we face that question? We see what Lot chose, And ultimately, we see what it did to his family. Maybe keeping your place there in Genesis chapter 19, if you want to mark that. May I suggest the second thing that we see with Lot is that worldliness bothered Lot, but he was still a part of it. And maybe that's a sign of confirmation with the world when worldliness bothers us and we don't like it, but we're still a part of it and we go along with worldliness. Look in 2 Peter chapter 2, if you've marked your spot there in Genesis chapter 19. We'll get right back there. But in 2 Peter chapter 2, starting there in verse 6, Peter's describing the doom that comes upon the unrighteous in comparison to the godly. And he says in verse 6, "And turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, condemned them to destruction, making them an example to those who afterward would live ungodly." And everybody knows Sodom and Gomorrah. That's an example to everyone who would live that way. Verse 7, "And delivered righteous Lot, who was oppressed by the filthy conduct of the wicked." Verse 8, "For that righteous man, dwelling among them, tormented his righteous soul from day to day by seeing and hearing their lawless deeds." The old King James says it vexed his soul. Seeing all of this worldliness and ungodliness, it bothered Lot. And ultimately, God delivered him, and he wasn't destroyed along with Sodom and Gomorrah. But what happened? He lost his family because he chose to still live there. He was still involved with the world. He put up with it, right? Maybe that's just the cost of doing business as we think about it. That's just the world in which we live. Do we just put up with the things we know we shouldn't? Or do we take a stand against those things? I'm so proud of so many of y'all because I know of the stands that you take against worldliness. I know of some of you who have said to your boss, "I'm not going to go and be at that work function because of how much alcohol is involved and the things that take place there." I know of some of you who've said, "My kid is not going to play that game or make that practice because it interferes with worshiping God." Keep it up. And if you find yourself in a situation where you say to yourself, "This isn't right, I don't think I ought to be there," well, maybe the first time is shame on them. But don't be a part of that anymore. Worldliness has to do more than bother us. We have to refuse to be a part of the worldliness that takes place so often. Number three, we might be conformed to the world if we become more and more entangled with the world. Now we're there in Genesis chapter 19. Notice there in verse 1. "Now the two angels came to Sodom," the two angels that visited Abraham and told him that Sodom and Gomorrah was going to be destroyed. Those two angels came to Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom. When Lot saw them, he rose to meet them and bowed himself with his face to the ground. Now, we see the progression here with Lot, right? At first, he just settled on the plain where everything was nice and beautiful. But apparently, at some point, he moved into the city of Sodom itself. And then he didn't just move into the city of Sodom. Now he is sitting in the gates. He has this position of authority. He's a part of the local politics in Sodom. And then his daughters marry men who are from Sodom, apparently. May I suggest that Lot was getting closer and closer to the world, and eventually he just invited the world right into his house. And sometimes we invite the world right into our house, don't we? And what we watch on TV, and who we follow on social media, in the video games we play, and what music we listen to, or perhaps even who our closest friends are. All of that becomes part of our world. Instead of us having the influence, it influences us. And apparently that's what was happening with Lot and his family. And maybe sometimes we fall into that trap where we act better than the world, but we're only really righteous when we compare ourselves with the world, not by any sort of objective standard that God gives. We see in verses 2 through 8, that Lot invites these men into his house. In fact, he insists that they come there. But then the men of the city, they come and they pound on the door and they say, "Send out those men who came to you that we might know them carnally." But Lot is, in many ways, a righteous man. I'm not going to contradict Peter on that. And so he's better than these other men. And he comes out and he faces them and he says, "Please, my brethren, do not do so wickedly." And Lot does a lot of good things in this text. And then we get to verse 8, and I don't know about you, but it's blindsiding to me every single time. Lot says, "See now, I have two daughters who have not known a man. Please let me bring them out to you, and you may do to them as you wish. Only do nothing to these men, since this is the reason they have come under the shadow of my roof." Lot was way better than Sodom. But he chose to do this. And yes, if you want to compare him to the men who are beating down the door, Lot was better, but this is the hero of the text. And I think sometimes we fall into that same trap. I'm better than everyone around me. I'm better than everyone around me at work. I'm better than everyone around me at school. Our little pod of the family is better than the rest of the family. And all of a sudden we think that justifies us. I speak better than those who are around me. I don't cuss, but, well, maybe I let OMG slip out every once in a while. You know, I dress better than everybody around me. Yeah, it's probably immodest, but it's not as immodest. You know, I look at porn from time to time, but I don't cheat on my wife or on my husband. Yeah, I'll slow dance with my girlfriend, but I don't dirty dance like everybody else does. Yeah, I'll drink socially, but I don't get drunk. I'm not committed to Christ Monday through Friday, but boy, I go to church on the weekends. In none of those things can we find ourselves justified by God. We have an absolute standard from God, not a relative standard. And being better than the world is not the same as being right with God. And comparing ourselves with ourselves, we can become fools. And we need to make sure that we're getting back to what God would have us to do, not just comparing ourselves with the world. Well, sometimes we're conformed when we reject without genuine consideration calls to get out of the world. Or perhaps we put it off until we are ready. We see there with Lot, when these angels tell them they have to get out, they have to get out of the city, the angels struck all these men with blindness and they say, "Look, this place is going to be destroyed. Take your family and get out." And in verse 14, so Lot went and spoke to his sons-in-law who had married his daughters, and he said, "Get up, get out of this place, for the Lord will destroy this city." But to his sons-in-laws, it seemed that he was joking. "You got to be kidding me, Lot. Nothing's going to be destroyed. What are you talking about?" They didn't take him seriously in his calls to get out of the world. And I fear sometimes we as Christians avoid studying an issue because we're comfortable with what we already believe. The conclusion is drawn, so why study it any further? And certainly this applies to matters of worldliness. I like what it is I'm doing, and my conscience doesn't bother me, and so it's easier just to reject it when somebody suggests that maybe this is something that I need to think about. To blow it off like his sons-in-laws did here, instead of taking the time to honestly and genuinely consider it and study it for ourselves. Well, maybe we do study it, and we come to the conclusion, yeah, that's what I need to do, but we put it off because we're just not ready to let go of it. Isn't that what Lot does here? When morning had dawned, verse 15, angels urged Lot to hurry, saying, "Arise, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, lest you be consumed in the punishment of the city." And while he lingered, the men took hold of his hand, his wife's hand, and the hands of his two daughters, the Lord being merciful to him, and they brought him out and set him outside the city. He's lingering, knowing what God is going to do. And sometimes maybe that's what we do if we're conforming ourselves to the world. I know what I need to do, but I'm not ready to do it yet. I'm not ready to make the commitment. But there's urgency here. Our souls are on the line. And maybe we're conformed to the world when we are not willing to fully give up the world. Or maybe we even desire to go back to the world. We see Lot's excuses. Hey, don't send me up into the mountains. There's a little city over there. I like how he emphasizes that several times, right? It's just a little one. It's just a little city. There's just a little bit of worldliness over there. Let me go there because I'm scared to go up into the mountains. And so finally the angels relent and say, okay, go to that little city. But then we see with Lot's wife there in verse 26, but his wife looked back behind him and she became a pillar of salt. Sometimes we're like Lot. I'll leave, but, you know, let me go somewhere relatively close. Let me be a Christian, but I want to live the same basic lifestyle I lived before I was a Christian. Or like Lot's wife, maybe we look back at the life we once had with yearning, or the life that our friends have who are in the world and say, oh, for one weekend, I wish I could go back. Oh, I wish I could do all of those things and still be a Christian. You know what Lot's wife was missing out on? She was missing out on death. And when she looked back at it with yearning, that's exactly what she got. We're not missing out on anything worthwhile when we look back on the world. But if we start yearning for those things, we'll be conformed to the world, if nowhere else than in our own mind. And then finally, we can identify confirmation with the world in ourselves when we don't instill our spiritual knowledge and conviction on the next generation. May I suggest that Lot's daughters probably knew what was right and what was wrong, but when the situation changes, they give that up, don't they? And we see their sin in verses 30 through 38. They were willing to do wrong because there was no depth of spirituality there. There was no commitment to God. And we can raise kids who have good morality, but do they have spirituality? You know, you probably know. Somebody said, do you have any black sheep in your family? And I said, yeah, we're the black sheep in our family, you know. There's a lot of non-Christians in the McClinney family. There's a lot of Christians, too. But non-Christians outnumber the Christians. But one thing that is true of almost all McClinneys is that we're monogamous people. Once we commit, we don't cheat with the person that we're with. Maybe that one bit of morality stuck with the non-Christians. And it's a wonderful trait, but that alone won't save anyone. If we raise good, moral, socially productive non-Christians, then ultimately it's still a failure for our children. Why are they living morally? Is it to please God or to obey us? That makes all the difference. And so we need to look at ourselves honestly. Compare ourselves with a man like Lot, who is called righteous in 2 Peter, and say, have I conformed with the world like Lot and his family? And if I have, or even if I say, you know what, I don't think I have, at least not fully, we still need to take this second step that we find there in Romans chapter 12. And that is that we need to embrace transformation. We can't just be okay with transformation. Yeah, God can change me if that's what He wants to do. It must be embraced. We have to be 100% committed to being transformed. And transformation means we are fundamentally changing who we are and there is no going back. And how does the text in Romans chapter 12 describe that transformation? But be ye transformed by what? By the renewing of your mind. In other words, Paul says that you change the way you act by changing the way you think. If your mind is renewed, then your actions will be renewed. You will be transformed. And may I suggest that there are three big areas suggested in Romans chapter 12 where we need that kind of transformation in our lives. Number one, we need to change the way we think about life. Is life about the physical or is life about the spiritual? Do you see God as real and present and the spiritual world as real and present? Do you set your mind on things above? Where are you headed in life? Are you giving your life as a spiritual, living sacrifice to God, or is it a physical, dying sacrifice to self? Where are you trying to go in life? I think Colossians chapter 3 is a great place to emphasize these thoughts. The book of Colossians in the third chapter, beginning there in verse 1. Notice verses 1 and 2 to begin with me. If then you were raised with Christ. Paul says, if you have become a Christian, you're raised with Christ. Seek those things which are above, where Christ is, sitting at the right hand of God. Set your mind on things above, not on things on the earth. Set your mind on things above, the things of a spiritual nature, not on things of the earth, not these worldly, carnal things. Do you know where you're going in your life? He says, set your mind on things above. It's not just, okay, these are the things that I think about, these are the things that I meditate on. Certainly that's true, right? But it's really more like setting your GPS, right? Setting the GPS on your phone. I put in the address, it's set, now I'm going there. And we even say that about people, right? He had his mind set on that promotion. Well, what does that mean? That he worked for that, that he worked hard for that, that that's what he or she wanted. And so it means that this is not just the things we think about, but what we yearn for, what we delight in, and what we will do no matter what. Those are the things that we've set our mind on. And if you really know where you want to go, you will go there. You'll make it happen. And so the question for all of us is heaven where you really want to go? Is that where you have set your mind? Is that the thing for which everything in your life is working toward? Because we set goals about what we want to do and where we want to go and what we want to achieve in life. But if this isn't the number one goal, we have not set our mind on things above. But instead, they are still on things on the earth. We have to change the way we think about life. That we're going somewhere, and I'm going to get there no matter what. And then secondly, we need to renew our mind by changing the way we think about ourselves. He says, give your body as a living sacrifice. I'm supposed to be holy, acceptable to God. I'm supposed to not be sinful anymore. I'm supposed to be something better, a new creation, transformed into the image of He who created me. Bill Reeves says all the time, you know Greek. Well, I'm gonna steal that from him. You know Greek? You do. You know what this word for transformation is in Greek? It is metamorpho. Well, you know that word, don't you? Metamorphosis. You learned that as a little kid, right? That there's a little caterpillar and it has a cocoon and then it comes out. It has a metamorphosis and now it's a butterfly, right? And so what God is saying here is you need to have a metamorphosis, that you're a caterpillar, but now you're a butterfly in Jesus Christ, and you don't want to go back to being a caterpillar anymore. You fundamentally change who you are to be conformed to the image of Christ. You're still there in Colossians chapter 3. Let's keep reading. Look at verses 3 and 4. He says, for you died, who you were died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is our life, appears, then you will also appear with Him in glory. Do you know who you are? You died, and now Christ lives in you. Do you know who you are? Y'all know how much I love to people watch. That's something I've done all my life. I did it with my dad a lot growing up. Well, when I was in San Antonio, Stephanie and the girls came the last couple of days of the meeting that I was preaching there. And so that meant that I needed to go and get coffee for Steph, right? And so I went and just went to the closest coffee shop to where we were staying. And I walk in, and it's like this hipster joint, right? That's really the only way you can describe it. And some of the people in there were just fascinating to me. So you've got this dude who rides up on his bike, right? And he was wearing the shortest shorts I've ever seen, man or woman, anybody. And he struts in like he owns that place, right? I'm like, you be you, man, all right? It was awkward, right? And then one of the guys behind the counter, he had this neck beard, right? And this neck beard came out to like right here, but it was all clean shaven up here. And I was like, I've never seen that style, but man, go for it. Nothing wrong with that one. Now the shorts over here, I have a problem with that. But the neck beard, you know, if that's what you want to do, that's what you want to do. Now, apparently, they have a BYOB policy at this coffee shop because there was a woman who literally had a bottle of champagne with her French toast. And she was there drinking. It was 9 in the morning, right? And she's drinking with her French toast. And next to her was a lady with a jogging stroller. And you say, well, that's not weird. She had a dog in the jogging stroller. Well, what do all of those people have in common? The temptation is to say, well, nothing, except that's just odd, right? They're all trying to show who they are, right? They all have an image that they're trying to project. Why do people dress like they do? Why do they act like they do? Why do they speak like they do? Because they have an image of who they think they are that they want the rest of the world to see them as well. They're projecting that image. Now, I would suggest that most people in the world don't have that figured out. It's one image one week and another the other. But they're trying to figure out, who am I? If you have been raised with Christ, you've figured out who you are. I am Jesus Christ. Not just in what you wear, though that should be true, obviously. But that fact defines your character. That defines your existence. You become Christ. As he says there in verse 3, for your life is hidden with Christ in God. If you want to find out who I am, find Christ. Because that is who I am. I've told you before, Galatians 2 and verse 20, maybe my favorite passage in the whole New Testament. For I have been crucified with Christ. Nevertheless, I live. Yet not I, but Christ lives in me. And the life which I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God, who loved me and gave Himself for me. Christ is in me. Not that I could open up my chest and, hey, look, Christ is in there. But Christ is in me, spiritually and figuratively, when I act like Him. It is no longer I, but Christ. I have become an instrument of God to do His will. I am renewed in knowledge according to the image of Him who created me. Isn't that what He goes on to say in Colossians here? He says there, if we continue reading in verse 5, therefore put to death your members which are on earth. That's worldliness, right? Fornication, uncleanness, passion, evil desire, covetousness, which is idolatry. Because of these things, the wrath of God is coming upon the sons of disobedience, just like it did on Sodom and Gomorrah, in which you yourselves once walked when you lived in them. That was the old man. But now you yourselves are to put off all of these: anger, wrath, malice, blasphemy, filthy language out of your mouth. Do not lie to one another, since you have put off the old man with his deeds and have put on the new man, who is renewed in knowledge according to the image of Him who created him. Do you know what Christians do? Christians behave themselves. They don't live filthy lives. They live spiritual lives. You used to live like that. But we don't do that anymore. Because I'm Jesus Christ. Because I have put on the image of Jesus Christ. That's who I'm trying to be. As Ephesians 4 and verse 23 says, we are renewed in the spirit of our mind when we put off the old man and put on the new. We think about and do things differently. Well, what things? We need to change the way we think about God's direction. That God's direction, that His will is not burdensome. That God's will works. It is for our good always. As our text there in Romans chapter 12 says, be transformed by the renewing of your mind that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. We need to approve of God's way in our own mind. Is this what I really believe is best? And then I need to prove it to the world that God's way works. I want to show the world that they're missing out because they're not in Jesus. Because they aren't following God's directions. That I'm not the one who's missing out. They are. I need to change the way I think about God's direction. That it is not a burden. but a blessing.
1 John chapter 5. You turn over there with me, please. 1 John chapter 5.
This will be the last verse to which we will turn this morning. 1 John chapter 5. Begin reading with me there in verse 1, if you would. Whoever believes that Jesus is the Christ is born of God, and everyone who loves Him who begot also loves Him who is begotten of Him. So if you love God, you love Christ. If you love Christ, you love God. By this we know that we love the children of God, when we love God and keep His commandments. For this is the love of God. You want to say you love God? Here's how you show it. That we keep His commandments, and His commandments are not burdensome. For whatever is born of God overcomes the world. Remember how we started this whole thing? That we have to be overcomers. We have to overcome the world. How? And this is the victory that has overcome the world. Our faith. Your faith. If you want to overcome the world, put your faith in God's plans. Follow God's direction. Because He sees more clearly than we do, so we need to follow Him. As I said, we were in San Antonio. And we were in the parking lot there where we were staying. And there were all these cars, lots of trucks. You know, it's Texas, so there's lots of trucks. And our car was parked across the parking lot. So you've got a road here and parks over here and parks over here. And Madison was running on ahead. And so she's running and she's running toward the car. And I see this other car coming up the road way too quickly, right? And you have that moment of panic as a parent. And so the only thing I could do is stop! And she stopped. Now, she's trained. She's supposed to look both ways before she crosses the road. Hopefully she would have done that when she got there. But to her, the coast was clear. There were trucks on both sides. She couldn't see that car coming. The way looked without any danger. No problems. No issues. But I could see the car coming. From my vantage point up above the rest of it, I could see the car coming. And from God's vantage point, He can see things coming that we don't. For that moment, I could see the future. And God knows the end of a thing from the beginning. He sees eternity. And we have to trust His Word even when we don't fully understand it. Does that mean we will always see and fully understand? Of course not. How can we as physical beings? But we have to trust and obey. So that leaves all of us this morning with a choice. We have to make the choice. And we know the passages, Joshua 24:15, choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve, but as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. 1 Kings 18 and verse 21, where Elijah says, how long will you falter between two opinions? If Baal is God, serve him. If God is God, serve him. But they answered not a word. Jesus says we can't do that. Matthew 6, 24, no one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon, God and the world. James 4 and verse 4, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Whoever therefore wants to make himself a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. Make the choice in your mind and then live the choice in your life. Let's end by putting worldliness in these terms. You might wonder, why do I have a rope up here? It's not just because that's a pretty picture, although it is a pretty picture, isn't it? I want to end with this image. And I began this image a few weeks ago, and I've thought about it a lot more since then. I want us to think about, for just a moment, our battle with the world as a great tug of war. And God draws a line, and He says, this is righteousness. This is where I want you to be. I'm planting you right here, and I'm giving you this rope, and on the other side is the world. And you need to stay here where I have planted you, in righteousness. And you need to pull against the pressures of the world. Well, there are a lot of ways that could go wrong, right? For some Christians, as we talked about a few weeks ago, for some Christians, they've got this distance between them and the world. And so the world takes a step and they take a step and they're pulled along by the world. And they say, I'm all right. I'm doing okay. The world is still right over there. The world is still right over there. But they've left the righteousness of God a long time ago. For others, God plants us here and He says, pick up the rope. And we pick up the rope and we're pulling against the world. But the world is strong. The world has influence. It's difficult. And we feel ourselves being pulled a little bit. So some people, they just let go of the rope. And they say, the world is too strong. I just need to get away from this whole contest. And so the world goes faster and further. Because we're not being salt and light like we ought to be. We're not having the influence on the world. We're not pulling against the world like we ought to as Christians. For others, some Christians, they say, I don't know, this is pretty close to the line right here where God has planted me. And so they take a couple of steps back and they say, okay, that's better. I'm further from the world and I'm further from the line. And that's okay if that's what you want to do. The problem comes in is some Christians, they get the piece of chalk out of their back pocket and they draw the line and they say, okay, that's God's line right there. All you people are in trouble because I'm behind God's line. When it's really the line that we've drawn for ourselves. And saddest of all, there are some people who say, I don't want any part of it. They never pick up the rope to begin with. And they say, I'm not on either side. But that's just not true. Because the fact of the matter is, if we don't choose sides, we're ushered right over here that we might pull as the world pulls. And maybe we say to ourselves, it's tough. And yes, I'm here where God wants me to be, but I feel the pull of the world and I'm not strong enough. The world is big and strong and powerful and has influence over me and on my family. But we need to remember that we are not pulling alone. That the one pulling on our side is going to win. That the one pulling on our side is a God who has an inexhaustible source of strength, who neither faints nor grows weary. And if we will just stay where He has planted us on our side of the rope, He will win. But we have to be on His side if we want to win too. We have to overcome worldliness through the strength He provides. If you're not yet a Christian this morning, the world is stronger than you. We have all sinned and fallen short of the glory of God, but it is not stronger than God. And He has given you a way, a hope, to come to Him, to be on the winning side, and to have all of the spoils that come with that victory of a heavenly hope with Him. If you know what you need to do this morning, you know you need to put Christ on in baptism to be conformed to the image of His Son, to be raised to walk in newness of life. Don't wait a moment longer. Come now, while together we stand and while we sing.